Okay, we are recording.
Well, welcome back, everyone. We are here with Don Cooper talking about localism. This is part two. We spoke earlier in part one. And so today, what if we talk about your thoughts on the legitimacy of the state, Don?
Thanks, Jan. Yes, I think that a lot of people might, even just asking that question, a lot of people might think, oh, are you even thinking the state is legitimate? Should we be overthrowing the state? I am not talking about that. No, not in a million years. I'm not talking about any kind of violence. I'm not talking about any kind of direct challenge to authority. We have some form of democracy. We have voting. We can express ourselves that way already. What I'm talking about is changing our minds and our relationship with the state over time in a peaceful manner. I think that this is really about us taking back our responsibility, taking back our power through taking responsibility as a community. In order to move forward, in order to make things better, we have to be critical. We have to think through things and be willing to throw certain things out, consider new things. This is critiquing, criticizing. This is not the same as trashing or wanting to smear or unnecessarily people's good work, people's good intentions. This is really about saying what's effective and what's not. What is hurting us, even through good intentions? And how could we do things smarter? And so if certain people's domain of authority is affected by that, in as much as we're doing this in a peaceful way, then that's a good thing. And the people who are affected, if they're good people, will willingly step aside over time again. And for example, I'm talking about a subsistence independent community. Now, if everybody was subsistent independent, then the people running, for example, welfare, they would no longer need to do that job. And that's what I mean by stepping aside. Now, obviously, they have nothing to fear for their jobs right now because there's a lot of people that need that kind of help. But it should be our goal to put them out of work. It should be our goal to make everybody guaranteeing their subsistence no matter what. And because we can do it as a community, then this is one less thing that the state has to do. So what are we really talking about here? We're not talking about overthrowing the state. We're not talking about getting rid of the state completely. We're talking about shrinking the state through a process of attrition, a slow, inevitable process that is completely peaceful.
Okay. And you were wanting to discuss elements of becoming a cooperative and how sophisticated a cooperative can arise out of this sophistication.
Right. Well, there's a couple of things here. First of all, people are going to say, what are you talking about? What is a cooperative? You know, I've heard of cooperatives before, but you're talking about subsistence independence, you know, and you're talking about not bringing anything else but subsistence into the picture. So what exactly are you talking about here? Well, we're talking about the benefits that arise from people working together. There's always efficiencies that are created from that. When, for example, if you buy a bag of rice at the store, you're going to be paying, let's just say, $10 per unit of weight. And if you buy 1,000 of those units, then you're going to be paying a penny per unit of weight. Mm-hmm. So simply by buying things together, we've already created an efficiency economically.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes sense for us to buy things together when it comes to food. And people do this. They have co-ops. They have food co-ops.
Mm-hmm.
And they do it for a variety of reasons. But one of them could be that they want organic food at a cheap price. And they're buying it together. And they're controlling their sources together so that they have the real stuff and not the stuff that they're getting from the supermarkets that they don't want, which is the pesticides and other things and the expensive prices. Although people do say that co-ops can be expensive, I think that I think nobody can deny that when you buy things together, just the direct concept of buying things together, you're buying a lot more, and so therefore there's a cheaper price. That's just an economic law.
And you weren't talking about before of it being really rather large communities. You're talking about local communities where not a lot of people are getting together,
right,
all in one group, and they're going to different groups.
Yeah, this is the thing about the community cooperative. I mean, I have no idea what the numbers are here, but I always talk about walking distance, because that's your physical place, and there's a deep meaning to your physical location and to why somebody is living across the street or in the next apartment to you. And in a place like New York City, you may never see the person who's living next to you, but nonetheless, there's still some deep mystical reason why that person is living right next to you. And you could exploit that meaning. You could open that up. You could create something wonderful and efficient and empowering if you just knocked on their door and established a relationship with them. But you don't have any reason to knock on their door. But if you had a community cooperative, you would have a reason to get to know people, and you would be creating efficiencies, and spontaneously you'd be getting benefits out of that because of the power that would be unleashed from that, from these relationships. And the numbers of people is really determined by the costs of the means of subsistence and how you organize the structure in which you're paying for that. You might be able to make it work with just a few people, but then you'd have a lot of high costs that everybody would have to bear. Or you could do it with 1,000 people, and you'd really be able to defray the costs very, very significantly. I think that you're going to be talking about between dozens and hundreds as your round numbers of what these community cooperatives would look like. Now, people immediately say, okay, I keep thinking of this touchy-feely place in the woods where everybody's holding hands around a circle. I can't get my mind off of that. And I'm trying to say, what would the community cooperative look like? It wouldn't look any different than what you see now. It would be exactly the same. It's actually no different at all. It's just a piece of paper that everybody would sign and agree to, a trust, where they would agree to work together to guarantee the subsistence of everybody in the community. They would agree to a rotation. They would agree to some sort of financial commitment. And they would agree to a new definition of what their ownership over their means of subsistence, like their house, is. Now, that's a whole nother subject that we can go into, but I, for the sake of argument, I'm just saying that the community cooperative is just an agreement. And it's an idea of making a commitment to everybody's subsistence in order to free each other from wage slavery. And it's not not for the purpose of overthrowing the capitalist system, not for the purpose of overthrowing the government. It's just to take back our power from those abstractions, to the point that we empower ourselves so that when we do interface with those abstractions, we are much more empowered. And this includes your boss. Now you don't have to accept their offer. You can go somewhere else, or you can wait, or not somewhere else, you can wait. And with the state, you can you'll never have to talk to the state about getting food or getting housing. You'll never have to do that again. Now you're much more empowered in your relationship with the state. So in a sense, you are sovereign. Your community has created a kind of sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
And this is much, much better for you as an individual in terms of guaranteeing your personal freedoms and your opportunities, because you're going to be able to do what you really want with your own time. This is really the end result. Is not something you see in front of you. It's what people are actually doing with their time. That's the difference.
You talked earlier about the crafters, the life people would open up to learning new crafts or becoming better in the craft that they're at because they're free to do that.
And well, and this is the point about sophistication, the overall point, which is that when you unleash people's personal power, in other words, really, when you unleash their time, you free them from having to maintain their means of subsistence for themselves and their family in such an onerous individual manner. Then people are really doing what they want with their time, and spontaneously, which means nothing's forced, it just happens. People are doing crafts, people are doing more academic work that doesn't necessarily lead to making money. People are maybe doing meditation and spiritual work. A lot of people are saying, yeah, and a lot of people are just sitting around watching TV and being lazy. Well, yeah, there's going to be some of that, but we can't really get away from that no matter what. There's always going to be people like that. And I feel like laziness is really a pathology that's a response to learned helplessness. And a community cooperative, you're much less likely to have that kind of behavior, because you're going to have so many inspiring people are going to be living around other people who are so inspiring. And truly having the time to do what you want to do, we need to see that as liberating, not, oh my God, everybody's going to be lazy. What's that?
You don't want anybody policing anybody else. It's just about freeing people to be inspired.
Right, and the exigency here is about the freeing people. It's not, the exigency is not, oh my God, we have a bunch of lazy people and we have to whip them into shape. That's not really the problem in our society. That's just, there is always a group of people that are like that, but they're not the cause of human misery. The cause of human misery is that people are locked into wage slavery. And on the other half of the planet, people don't have any opportunities at all because they're out. They're just not even needed in the capitalist system. So they're living in places where giant corporations are sucking out the resources from their countries, vampiring them essentially, and these people are left with nothing, and they're immiserated in an even deeper sense than the people in the so-called first world. In the first world, the big negative factor is stress for maintaining your means of subsistence, having that job, keeping that job, and then when you're in that job, you're miserable in that job. So the subsistence independent community solves both problems at the same time. For the people in the first world, it eliminates the stress of wage slavery. In the so-called third world, it guarantees subsistence, which people don't even know if their next meal is coming. But if they work together, they could guarantee that for themselves.
You talked about Europe and how they have an older sovereignty and an older system, not so much system, but
culture
where we as the United States, because we're so much younger, are not as sophisticated in a lot of ways.
Well, I think that's just a plain fact of time, but it's also a plain fact of a kind of retrograde in our culture. 100 years ago, for example, there used to be dozens and dozens of newspapers just in New York City. And I'm not going to say how many numbers, but there were a proliferation of breweries, okay? Beer making, it's a craft. And what happened after World War II is that beer making turned into a very generic thing. And in America, but not in Europe, but in America, we had a vanillaization of our culture in many different ways. And you could, I'm just using beer making as one example. You know, you had Budweiser, Miller, Coors, and just Pilsner beer. That was it. Because it was easy to mass produce that type of beer. But then in the 90s, we get this the microbrew revolution begins. And now people have kind of clawed back and pulled back their beer making culture. And now we have ales, we have stouts, we have all kinds of interesting, wonderful beers. And because people are saying, no, you can't make me into a vanilla robot. You can't vanillaize my culture. You can't genericize my culture. And so why did that happen? Why did we go backwards? It was because we were losing our communities and we were losing our culture because we were hypermobilized and we were disempowered individually and as communities. So we go to the store for convenience and we'd look at the display and we'd you know, very easily buy things, and that was wonderful. But there was a cost to that. There was a negative. There was a downside to that because of the way the system was built. And I'm arguing that localism would bring back these elements that we've lost. For example, a local community would have a beer maker, a local beer maker, a local wine maker, a local bread maker, a local glass maker, a machinist. Make anything you can possibly imagine. A wood craftsman, make any kind of furniture you can possibly imagine. A painter, a sculptor, a musician, a recording studio. Imagine a community having all of these things. Even a math teacher, not high school level, college level. A physicist. Okay, a chemist, a local chemist. And I'm talking about an actual scientist.
We don't even know who our neighbors are. I could have a scientist living two doors down from me.
And you probably do, but probably you don't get any benefits out of that.
That's right. We don't know our neighbors anymore.
Right. But imagine a community. Now, I'm not saying, okay, in order to have a subsistence community, we have to have a physicist, we have to have a mathematician, we have to have a... No. I'm saying these things would just spontaneously arise over time. And the infrastructure for these people to do their work locally, when it made sense, when the will was there, not forced, it just arose spontaneously. And I'm saying it would happen because people want to have these kinds, access to these kinds of things. They would love to have to be able to sit and listen to a mathematician speak for a little while. And get the benefit of their knowledge. It's not that you can't do that now. You can go to a university and you can take classes or you can just listen to a lecture. But I'm saying over time, the sophistication of the community would start to escalate dramatically just within a generation. And then within two generations, it would be mind-blowing because there would be an emphasis on... Well, because people are doing what they really want to do, nobody's going to have to fit into some sort of bureaucratic cog in order to do that thing. So if a person wanted to be like a physicist, but they didn't want to be the greatest physicist in the world, so they can't compete with the people that are actually professors at universities, but they would like to spend most of their time doing physics, they'd be able to do that. And then over time... You might get two or three people that are really into physics, and out of a few hundred that just like are doing it all the time, and suddenly you have a little room somewhere in the community where, oh yeah, you want to learn about physics? Go talk to Mike. And then there's going to become a point, a gray area, where people are going to be like, do I need to go to university? Or maybe I can just talk to Mike. You know, literally, like, there's going to be a transition where learning up to a certain level is we're going to take back from the bureaucracies the systems of learning. And this is going to democratize learning, because let's face it, if you really want to learn physics, not only do you have to be the best in mathematics, which I think is unfair right there. That's unfair. You have to get 800, a very high score on your SAT in order to get into an elite university. Why is it elite? Because we only have a couple of them. So there's, as the population grows and they don't create more universities, there's just more competition to get into them. And now we have this hyper-competitive model of education. Yeah. So why not take back that power? Right? We're taking back subsistence, but we could also take back education to a large degree. Not totally, not trashing what's there, but a process of attrition. Right. Saying, you know what, you guys have a big head. You guys think you know everything, and you want to make it all elitist, and you want to block most people who are interested in these things out. Well, you know what? We don't need you. We're going to do it ourselves. And over time, we're going to be just as good as you. Not right away, but over time, we will. It's going to happen. Because this is something that people want. If people are totally free with their time, think about it. What are they going to do with that time? There's going to be a lot of people who are going to be reading a ton of books on the subjects they're interested in. And they're going to get really good at it. And if you have enough people in your community, that means this guy's interested in this, that girl's interested in that, this person's interested in this. You're going to get a whole bunch of different subjects that you're going to have a bunch of experts on. Because people can do whatever they want. And so a lot of them are just going to be reading books and becoming experts. And they're going to be doing it without any help from any bureaucracy. And this is going to be so incredibly empowering. And in a positive way. Again, this is about taking back our power rather than challenging directly any current power. So it's really about liberation rather than confrontation.
Personal sovereignty. Do you want to talk about that now?
Right. So when we talk about the legitimacy of the state itself, we're talking about what do we need the state for? And I'm arguing we don't need as much of the state as we have. We need to shrink it. I said that at the outset. But we still need a state because there's things that the state does that act across communities. The problem is that one of the problems we have with the state, though, is that it wants to adjudicate over things that really come down to personal choice. And, you know, we have the Constitution. The Constitution is guaranteeing our freedom of speech, our freedom of thought, freedom of religion. Really, so it's thought and speech, but what about action? There's no real guarantee in the Constitution about action. So thought, speech, and action are really the core of our interface in this world. It defines us as individuals. We think, we talk, and we act. Our thinking and our talking are guaranteed, but not our action. And a huge amount of our action doesn't affect anybody else. It's really a zone of, I'm calling it personal sovereignty, but it's not sovereign. It's adjudicated by the state. The state says, oh, you can do this, but you can't do that. And these decisions are kind of come upon through the political process. So if one taboo wins out over another group that doesn't have that taboo, then that taboo stands. And this is always going to be a source of division. The state, when it's acting in a negative manner, is using divide and conquer strategy to split people and to get them into arguments that there's really never an answer to. So the people's will is not coming through. And so the state is in that direct sense is becoming a tyranny, maybe not for this group, but for that group. And so when you have a whole string of these issues, because you're not in the core respecting personal sovereignty, and I'm talking about action, what you make do with your body or consensually with another individual, that's also the zone of personal sovereignty. When you're not respecting that, you're not sanctifying the meaning of freedom. You're giving it a status that is subject to whim or definition of one group over another. All right. Well, I'm going to use marijuana as an example because I think that I'm not trying to promote marijuana. I'm just trying to use it as a philosophical tool because it really, no matter where you stand on the issue, it's really the perfect example of what I mean. Imagine a person in the middle of the woods, nobody around him for miles. Lights a joint, smokes it. Who has been hurt by that? There is nobody hurt by that. Anybody who says that somebody's getting hurt is they're talking. They can only talk in an indirect sense. You know, oh, there's a drug trade. People get killed in the drug trade. Oh, if he smokes enough of those, he could hurt himself. He might derange his mind. Oh, he might become lazy. We know there are a bunch of lazy workers. These are all you're talking about indirect effects, and you're talking about on the one hand, you're even talking about effects that wouldn't even exist if it were legal. So what we're really talking about, when you really get down to it, why is it illegal? It's because it's one group that has a taboo against it, won out in the democratic process over another. But that's really a form of tyranny from the point of view of the people that lost. Now, I'm not saying we need to enshrine the pot smoking as a freedom. I'm talking about we need to enshrine personal sovereignty, and the people that don't like pot smoking have to be big enough to allow the people that want to do it. And I'm going to include, I don't know, sexual activity, consensual sexual activity, the kind that people don't like. Some people don't like, but others engage in. I think it's very important that we really move beyond moralism in our political debates, because no matter how much you want to lecture people, they're never, ever, ever going to agree with you. And so if you want to bring in the police and the state and the courts, what you're doing is you're clogging up the system, and you're creating a top-heavy system that where you're giving too much power to a bureaucracy for very little benefit, if any. First of all, making drugs illegal. I personally believe all drugs should be legal because I don't think they should be promoted. I think they are very dangerous. But again, this is about personal sovereignty. And if we create a whole system, we create an entire bureaucracy, and we force the police to get involved in all this, we're creating a pathway for tyranny, and we're screwing around with the definition of freedom. That's the definition of freedom is so much more important than any of these taboos, even if you believe that that these things are wrong and they should not exist. The state and law is the wrong way to address the problem. People are drug addicts and have very negative behavior, mostly because of economic dislocation and lack of opportunities. It's really not because of the drugs themselves. It's not because of the availability. And the drugs are available, whether they're legal or not. I mean, you really don't have to work that hard. It's just they're more expensive. That's really what it comes down to. So what you're doing is you're creating a false economy, a black market, that in itself is very destructive. So in your moralizing, what you've done is you've created violence. You've created a counter effect. Now, I'm not saying that you know the people that are moralizing against that are wrong and that they've created this. I'm saying this is just an inevitable outcome. So why would you keep pushing this? Find another way to solve the problem. Don't ask the state to do it. And suddenly when you remove taboo and you enshrine personal sovereignty, and now you have the big three, thought, speech, and action, and you hold on to that as the core of your philosophy, now we really are talking about freedom. Because since the community cooperative is going to come in and stop wage slavery, and we would say in the third world, stop not wage slavery, but just stop starvation. Because the community cooperative can work in both contexts. It can work in the first world, that's freeing people from wage slavery. It can work in the third world, guaranteeing people subsistence there. In a community way. Now that you're respecting thought, speech, and action, and people are not starving or constantly worried about their jobs, you actually have created freedom. This is the key point here. There's really no other way to do this. There's no other way to actually have total freedom in its truest sense. You're not making up a story about how we're all free. Today, we're not free. We are not free. We talk about freedom. We talk about liberty and as wonderful things. And to a large degree, America and the Constitution was a landmark in human history, enshrining in law the freedom of speech and the freedom of thought. Was massive. Even in Europe today, they do not have freedom of speech. It's mind-boggling that such a sophisticated, amazing culture does not have it, but it does not have it. And we have it. And that makes us light years ahead of everybody else in a certain way. And this is really amazing, but we have not gone far enough. It's a half measure if we're just going to stop there and pretend that we're free. We're not. We are economic slaves. And if you research the social security system, we are actually literally chattel. That's what the social security card is. Your name in all capital letters means that a corporation, a straw man corporation, was created on your future labor, and they trade that corporation in the high financial world. Okay, so you are by definition chattel. People can look this up. It's absolutely 100% the truth. And if there's not a lot of jobs out there, you really feel your slavery. If you're coming out of a graduate school and you snap your fingers and you get hired, you don't feel your slavery. But that's not going to work for everybody, let's face it. And when we talk about robotization, automation, more and more people are not technically needed by the capitalist system. So in the 1800s and before that, yes, human labor was very important. In the 1900s, very important. This century, not so important. So let's get real, people. You know, it's, we got to prepare for this. It's called the leisure society in political theory terms. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about the lazy society. I'm talking about the leisure society. I'm talking about people literally doing what they want to do, because that's really, ironically, the only way we can guarantee our freedom. It's funny, but we have to actually get what we want in order to be free. But it's literally, there is no other way, because if we keep trying to shove the capitalist system down everybody's throats, what we're doing is we're in denial that we don't need everybody for the capitalist system. And if we try to shove the socialist system down everybody's throats, then we're in denial that we're not in agreement about culture and about how we want to interface with the state and what the state should and shouldn't be doing and how it should be running our lives or shouldn't be. We're in both ways. We're just asking for misery and unhappiness on the part of most of the people.
Right. What about talking about self-actualization? You just mentioned that, and you know, how it's not, in your estimation, a political theory either.
Right. Well, you got the I was saying socialism, capitalism. Socialists tend to be people, and I'm talking about high-mindedness. I mean, this is a, I love people for thinking so compassionately about their brothers and sisters who are not fortunate, who get the short end of the stick with the capitalist system, who are suffering, really suffering. And these are usually the people that are socialist in their thinking. They think, okay, if we get the right state combination together, we can solve these problems, we can end this. And I think they're wrong, because we're just asking the state, we're just saying, here's more power, take more power from us and just solve our problems. And when we do that, we're disempowering ourselves. And that's counterproductive to human freedom. On the other side, with people who are capitalists, they think, you know, we're in the doldrums right now. We just need to get the economy juiced up and booming again, and then everybody's going to have good jobs, and then everybody will be, you know, feel free, and they'll be able to do what they want to do. That's a different kind of, in the end, giving your power away, because it's not true that everybody's going to get jobs or good jobs. It's just never going to be true. So what these people do, the people that promote capitalism, a lot of them will go into the realms of self-actualization. They'll say, well, if everybody just really focused on something that they really loved, by the way, what they really love has to make money. We're not going to address that. We're just going to be in denial about that. But the truth is that what most people like to do has nothing to do with making money. So that's a non-starter right there. But nonetheless, they keep going when they say, all right, if everybody just was self... And by the way, I'm all about self-actualization. I love that. I think that's awesome. And I think that people making excuses for the obstacles in their lives, that's totally bullshit, and I don't accept that at all, and I think we should be self-actualizing. But self-actualization is not a political theory. Some people are doing it, some people aren't. Some people are caught in a very complex situations with their families. I mean, the reasons are endless why people are disempowered economically. And self-actualization is only part of the picture. It's not the whole thing. And even if it were, it's still not a political theory, because having compassion means accepting people for who and what they are right now, not what they could be, but what they are. And if they're not self-actualized, you still have to love them. You can't sit there wagging your finger at them. And you've got to come up with a theory that works for things as they are, not as you would like them to be. So you can keep preaching self-actualization, but don't start talking about it like it's going to be some sort of political solution. And don't start preaching and looking down on the people who are not self-actualized, because you might be self-actualized, you might be self-actualized economically, but you don't have the right to judge other people just because you made it. That's not compassionate, and that's not it's not even fair. And that's really what we're talking about, creating a fair, just society. And it's not fair if people are sitting in judgment of others all the time. So again, you know, when you're going either socialist or capitalist, you're always making some sort of excuses for the cracks in the system that you're creating, and for the reason why people are falling through, or for the reason why the state is kind of running roughshod over people's rights, or on the other hand, the corporations are running roughshod over people's rights. You're just saying, oh, if we just fix this entity, this abstraction, the state or the corporation, if we could just fix it and get the right people in there, everything will be fine. No, it never works. It will never, ever, ever work, because when you give your power away, you're creating the conditions for corruption. The people at the top are going to inevitably misuse that power, because it's not their proper domain. And this is why I'm talking about the legitimacy of the state. If we give the state its proper domain, if we define its proper domain, then the state could work very well with the people and provide, act as a facilitator for those things that are beyond the scope or the domain of a community. Building a giant road, you know, public works of all types. Another important point here is that I feel like something like the Food and Drug Administration it guarantees that, you know, when you go to the store, you're not going to get poisoned by the milk you drink. Okay, that's a wonderful thing. However, the Food and Drug Administration seems to feel like it has no limits on its domain, and it just comes up with more and more logical reasons why it needs to pass this law and that law and the other law. I'm talking about actually taking the teeth away completely from the Food and Drug Administrations, but keeping the scientists and the moral authority of the Food and Drug Administration. And this is one example, but you can replicate it over all the different agencies. I feel that until I sell you the milk, well, if I sell you the milk and I poison you, obviously I did something wrong. But if I sell you the milk and it's not what I, how do I put this? If the FDA simply released standards and the milk makers said, oh, I have milk that goes according to the FDA's standards. People would generally not buy milk unless it had that stamp on it, because that's safe milk. But if somebody sold that milk and it wasn't going according to those standards, then the state would have a legitimate reason to step in and say, you're committing fraud. You said it was going according to these standards and it's not, therefore we're going to prosecute. And they would absolutely be correct in doing so. But when we give the authority for the FDA to come in and say, this is how you make milk, and nobody can make milk unless they go according to our standards, well, now they've created a tyrannical system, and they're stifling innovation, and they're also stifling people who work outside of their taboos. I'm thinking of, for example, people who sell raw milk. Okay, now, I believe that people should be able to buy raw milk. And yes, some people get sick when they drink it, but I think that's okay. I don't want people to get poisoned by drinking bad milk, but the point is that it's counterproductive to impose, for the FDA to be imposing these standards. They're overreaching. That's not their proper domain. They could be using those scientists to create those standards, and most people are just not going to buy raw milk because they don't want to take their chance, and so they'll look for the mark, FDA approved, or FDA according to FDA standards. And if anybody dares at that point to sell milk where they mark it as FDA approved, but it's not going according to those standards, then we can justly ask the state to step in and prosecute, because that's fraud. And there's the two things that we really want to talk about when we're talking about the proper domain of the state, which is really the legitimacy of the state, is encroachment and fraud. The state protects us from encroachment, like some murderer coming in and trying to you know, hurt us. We ask the policeman to protect us from that. And that's legitimate, because there's crazy people running around trying to kill people sometimes. And so we ask a detective to go and find those people. And we've asked the police to stop, you know, somebody at a bar trying to smash somebody. But because that's something beyond our domain. And that's something where we can really use this external higher authority to come in and protect us. And then with fraud, it's kind of the same thing. You know, we've got nobody to appeal to if we don't have the state to protect us from that. But the state wants to take encroachment and fraud and just kind of keep expanding out from there, and just seeing and reinterpreting everything within their domain, because they're always coming back and saying, well, you know, this could hurt you and we're protecting you. Well, you know what? Maybe in certain situations, I don't want to be protected. I don't want to be protected from raw milk. Mm-hmm. I want to take the risk. I should be allowed to, because that's my freedom. Milk exists a priori before the state. Mm-hmm. Same with marijuana. These things exist before the state. So therefore, our law, if we make a law about it, that's artificial. That's not natural. We're not accepting nature as it is. Mm-hmm. So that you're creating you're screwing around with the meaning of freedom. And when you do that, you're asking for trouble. So we need to sanctify the meaning of freedom. And I'm not saying everybody has to run around drinking raw milk. Mm-hmm. That'll never happen, because most people will be like, no way, I want that FDA approval. And you know what? I totally 100% respect that. And I'm probably going to be in agreement with you most of the time. Once in a while, I'll have to say, I would like to try some raw milk. I would like to know what's going on. You know, I over in France, there's this thing about their cheese. And some of the cheese they're not allowed to sell, that they've been making for 1,000 years. And suddenly the EU says, oh, no, sorry, you can't do that anymore. It's not safe. Well, I'm sorry, but you're overstepping. This is our culture. And we should be, you know, I'm speaking as a Frenchman. And we want to do this, and you know, you're being a mean guy by telling us we can't, and we don't want mean guys telling us what to do. And you know, so that's just the point. Is just like what we're talking about is you know, encroachment. When you think of the government as providing the service of protecting us from encroachment and fraud, you're really getting down to the nub of it, of what it really should be doing. And when it says that you can't eat this cheese, they're not protecting you from fraud or encroachment at all. They're just making up something. They're just saying, you know, I want to have no limits to my domain. I want to determine what a human is, what the human's rights are. And by the way, ultimately, I'm not going to say it to your face, but I think that you're just a slave and I want to tell you what to do. And that's what we have. You know, I mean, people don't want to admit it, but that's literally how the people in the corridors of power, ultimately, when they're talking to each other, that's the kind of tone they're using a lot. And it's our fault that they're talking that way. Because we've given our power away. And so we need to take that back.
Very good. So it sounds to me like this is a good place to stop and reflect on what we've been talking about, and hopefully the others will reflect on your thoughts and see where this goes. Maybe we'll talk again.
Awesome. Okay. Thank you so much, Jan.
Thank you, sir. Have a good night.
All right, you too.